The starboard watch go to breakfast. Ah, there you are, Mr. Ricketts. I believe we may serve out a double allowance of cheese. There will be nothing hot for a while.
If I may say so, sir, said the purser, with a pale leer, I fancy there'll be something uncommon hot presently.
The starboard watch, summarily fed, took over the labouring sweeps while their shipmates set to their biscuit, cheese and grog, with a couple of hams from the gunroom. A brief, uneasy meal, for out there the wind was ruffling the sea, and it had chopped round 2 points. The French ships picked it up first, and it was striking to see how their tall, high-reaching sails sent them running on little more than an air. The Sophie's hard-won advance was wiped out in 20 minutes, and before her sails were drawing, the Dessay already had a bow wave, whiskers that could be seen from the quarter-deck. Sophie's sails were drawing now, but this creeping pace would never do. "In sweeps," said Jack. "Mr. Day, throw the guns overboard."
"Aye, aye, sir,"
said the gunner briskly. But his movements were strangely slow, unnatural and constrained, as he sprung the cap squares, like those of a man walking along the edge of a cliff by willpower alone. Stephen came on deck again, his hands neatly mittened. He saw the team of the starboard brass quarter-deck four-pounder with crows and handspike in their hands, and a common look of anxious, almost frightened concern waiting for the roll. It came, and they gently urged their gleaming, highly polished gun overboard, their pretty number 14 over the side. Its splash coincided exactly with the fountain thrown up not 10 yards away by a ball from the Desai's bow chaser, and the next gun went overboard with less ceremony. 14 splashes at half a ton apiece, then the heavy carriages over the rail after them, leaving the slashed breeching and the unhooked tackles on either side of the gaping ports. A desolation to be seen. He glanced forward, then astern, and understood the position. He pursed his lips and retired to the taffrail. The lightened Sophie gathered speed minute by minute, and as all this weight had gone from well above the waterline, she swam more upright, stiffer to the wind. The first of the Dessay's shot whipped through the topgallant sail, but the next two pitched short. There was still time for manoeuvre, for plenty of manoeuvre. For one thing, reflected Jack, he would be very much surprised if the Sophie could not come about twice as quickly as the 74. "Mr. Dalziel," he said, "we will go about and back again. Mr. Marshall, let her have plenty of way on her." It would be quite disastrous if the Sophie were to miss stays on her second turn, and these light airs were not what she liked. She never gave of her best until there was something of a sea running and at least one reef in her topsails. "Ready about?" the pipe twittered. The sloop luffed up, came into the wind, stayed beautifully, and filled on the larboard tack. Her bowlines were as taut as harp strings before the big 74 had even begun her turn. The swing began, however. The Dessay was in stays. Her yards were coming round. Her checkered side began to show, and Jack, seeing the first hint of her broadside in his glass, called out, "You'd better go below, Doctor." Stephen went, but no further than the cabin. And there, craning from the stern window, he saw the Dessay's hull vanish in smoke from stem to stern, perhaps a quarter of a minute after the Sophie had begun her reverse turn. The massive broadside, 928 pounds of iron, plunged into a wide area of sea away on the starboard beam and rather short, all except for the 2 36-pound balls which hummed ominously through the rigging, leaving a trail of limp, dangling cordage. For a moment it seemed that the Sophie might not stay, that she would fall impotently off, lose all her advantage, and expose herself to another such salute, more exactly aimed. But a sweet puff of air in her backed headsails pushed her round, and there she was on her former tack, gathering way before the Dessay's heavy yards were firmly braced, before her first manoeuvre was complete at all. The sloop had gained perhaps a quarter of a mile. "But he'll not let me do that again," reflected Jack. The Desaix was round on the starboard tack again, making good her loss, and all the while she fired steadily with her bow chasers, throwing her shot with remarkable accuracy as the range narrowed, just missing or else clipping the sails, compelling the sloop to jig every few minutes, slightly losing speed each time. The Formidable was lying on the other tack to prevent the Sophie slipping through, and the Indomptable was running westwards to haul her wind in half a mile or so for the same purpose. The Sophie's pursuers were roughly in line abreast behind her, and coming up fast as she ran sloping across their front. Already the 80-gun flagship had yawed to fire one broadside at no unlikely distance, and the grim Desaix, making short boards, had done so on each turn. The boatswain and his party were busy knotting, and there were some sad holes in the sails, but so far nothing essential had been struck, nor any man wounded. "Mr. Dalziel," said Jack, "start the stores over the side, if you please." The hatch covers came off, the holds emptied into the sea. Barrels of salt beef, barrels of pork, biscuit by the ton, peas, oatmeal, butter, cheese, vinegar, powder, shot. They started their water and pumped it overboard. A 24-pounder hulled the Sophie low under the counter, and at once the pumps began gushing sea as well as fresh water. "See how the carpenter's doing, Mr. Ricketts," said Jack. "Stores overboard, sir," reported the lieutenant. "Very good, Mr. Dalziel. Anchors away now and spars. Keep only the kedge." "Mr. Lyme says 2.5 feet in the well," said the midshipman, panting, "but he has a comfortable plug in the shot hole." Jack nodded, glancing back at the French squadron. There was no longer any hope of getting away from them close-hauled, but if he were to bear up, turning quickly and unexpectedly, he might be able to double back through their line, and then, with this breeze 1 or 2 points on her quarter and with the help of the slight following sea, her lightness and her liveliness, why, she might live to see Gibraltar yet. She was so light now, a cockle-shell, she might outrun them before the wind, and with any luck turning briskly she would gain a mile before the line of battleships could gather way on the new tack. To be sure, she'd have to survive a couple of broadsides as she passed through, but it was the only hope, and surprise was everything. "Mr. Dalziel," he said, "we will bear up in 2 minutes' time, set stunsails and run between the flagship and the 74. We must do it smartly before they're aware." He addressed these words to the lieutenant, but they were instantly understood by all hands, and the topmen hurried to their places, ready to race up and rig out the studdingsail booms. The whole crowded deck was intensely alive, poised. "Wait. Wait," murmured Jack, watching the Desaix coming up wide on the starboard beam. She was the one to beware of. She was tenably alert, and he longed to see her beginning to engage in some manoeuvre before he gave the word. To port lay the Formidable, overcrowded, no doubt, as flagships always were, and therefore less efficient in an emergency. "Wait. Wait," he said again, his eyes fixed on the Desaix. But her steady approach never varied, and when he counted 20 he cried, "Right!" The wheel span, the buoyant Sophie, turned like a weathercock, swinging towards the Formidable. The flagship instantly let fly, but her gunnery was not up to the Desaix, and the hurried broadside lashed the sea where the sloop had been rather than where she was. The Desaix's more deliberate offering was hampered by the fear of ricochets skipping as far as the Admiral, and only half a dozen of her balls did any harm. The rest fell short. The Sophie was through the line, not too badly mauled, certainly not disabled. Her studding-sails were set, and she was running fast with the wind where she liked it best. The surprise had been complete. And now the two sides were drawing away from one another fast, a mile in the first 5 minutes. The Desaix's second broadside, delivered at well over 1,000 yards, showed the effects of irritation and precipitancy. A splintering crash followed marked the utter destruction of the elm tree pump, but that was all. The flagship had obviously countermanded her second discharge, and for a while she kept to her course close-hauled as though the Sophie didn't exist. "We may have done it," said Jack inwardly, leaning his hands on the taffrail and staring back along the Sophie's lengthening wake. His heart was still beating with the tension of waiting for those broadsides, with the dread of what they might do to his Sophie. But now its beat had a different urgency. "We may have done it," he said again. Yet the words were scarcely formed in his mind before he saw a signal break out aboard the Admiral and the Desaix began to turn into the wind. The 74 came about as nimbly as a frigate, her yards traversed as though by clockwork, and it was clear that everything was tallied and belayed with the perfect regularity of a numerous and thoroughly well-trained crew. The Sophie had an excellent ship's company too, as attentive to their duty and as highly skilled as Jack could wish, but nothing that they could do would make her move through the water at more than 7 knots with this breeze, whereas in another quarter of an hour the Desaix was running at well over 8 without her studding-sails. She was not going to trouble herself with setting them. When they saw that, when the minutes went by and it was clear that she had not the least intention of setting them, then the Sophie's heart died within them. Jack looked up at the sky. It looked down on him, a broad and meaningless expanse with stray clouds passing over it. The wind wouldn't die away that afternoon. Night was still hours and hours away. How many? He glanced at his watch. 10:14. "Mr. Dalziel," he said, "I'm going into my cabin. Call me if anything whatever occurs. Mr. Richards, be so good as to tell Dr. Maturin, and I should like to speak to him. And Mr. Watt, let me have a couple of fathoms of logline and 3 or 4 belaying pins." In his cabin he made a parcel of his lead-covered signal book and some other secret papers, put the copper belaying pins into the bag of mail, lashed its neck tight, called for his best coat and put his commission into its inner pocket. The words, "Hereof nor you nor any of you may fail as you will answer the contrary at your peril," floated before his mind's eye, wonderfully clear. And Stephen came in. "There you are, my dear fellow," said Jack. "Now, I'm afraid that unless something very surprising happens, we're going to be taken or sunk in the next half hour." Stephen said, "Just so." And Jack continued, "So, if you have anything you particularly value, perhaps it would be wise to entrust it to me." "They robbed their prisoners, then?" asked Stephen. "Yes, sometimes. I was stripped to the bone when the Leander was taken, and they stole our surgeon's instruments before he could operate on our wounded. I will bring my instruments at once." "And your purse?" "Oh, yes, and my purse." Hurrying back on deck, Jack looked astern. He would never have believed the 74 could have come up so fast. "Masthead," he cried, "what do you see?" 7 ships of the line, just ahead. Half the Mediterranean fleet.
"Nothing, sir," answered the lookout slowly, after a most conscientious pause. "Mr. Dalziel, should I be knocked on the head by any chance, these go over the side at the last moment, of course," he said, tapping the parcel and the bag. Already the strict pattern of the sloop's behaviour was growing more fluid. The men were quiet and attentive. The watch-glass turned to the minute. 4 bells in the afternoon watch rang with singular precision, but there was a certain amount of movement, unreproved movement, up and down the forehatch. Men putting on their best clothes, 2 or 3 waistcoats together and a shore-going jacket on top, asking their particular officers to look after money or curious treasures in the faint hope they might be preserved. Babington had a carved whale's tooth in his hand, Lucock a Sicilian bull's pizzle. 2 men had already managed to get drunk, some wonderfully hidden savings, no doubt.
"Why does he not fire?" thought Jack.
The Desaix's bow chasers had been silent these 20 minutes.
though for the last mile or so of their course the Sophie had been well within range. Indeed, by now she was in musket shot, and the people in her bows could easily be told from one another. Seamen, marines, officers, one man had a wooden leg. What splendidly cut sails, he reflected. And at the same time the answer to his question came, "By God, she's going to riddle us with grape." That was why he had silently closed the range. Jack moved to the side, leaning over the hammock netting, he dropped his packets into the sea and saw them sink. In the bows of the Desaix there was a sudden movement, a response to an order. Jack stepped to the wheel, taking the spokes from the quartermaster's hands and looking back over his left shoulder. He felt the life of the sloop under his fingers, and he saw the Desaix beginning to yaw. She answered her helm as quickly as a cutter, and in three heartbeats there were her 37 guns coming round to bear. Jack heaved strongly at the wheel. The broadside's roar and the fall of the Sophie's main t'gallant mast and foretopsail yard came almost together. In the thunder, a hail of blocks, odd lengths of rope, splinters, the tremendous clang of a grapeshot striking the Sophie's bell, and then a silence. The greater part of the 74's round shot had passed a few yards ahead of her stem. The scattering grape shot had utterly wrecked her sails and rigging, had cut them to pieces. The next broadside must destroy her entirely. "Clew up," called Jack, continuing the turn that brought the Sophie into the wind. "Bondon, strike the colours." Chapter 12. The cabin of a ship of the line and the cabin of a sloop of war differ in size, but they have the same delightful curves in common, the same inward-sloping windows, and in the case of the Desaix and the Sophie, a good deal of the same quietly agreeable atmosphere. Jack sat gazing out of the 74's stern windows, out beyond the handsome gallery to Green Island and Cabrita Point, while Captain Christipaliere searched through his portfolio for a drawing he had made when he was last in Bath, a prisoner on parole. Admiral Linois' orders had required him to join the Franco-Spanish fleet in Cadiz, and he would have carried them out directly if, on reaching the Straits, he had not learned that instead of one or two ships of the line and a frigate, Sir James Saumarez had no less than 6 74s and an 80-gun ship watching the combined squadron. This state of affairs called for some reflection. So here he lay with his ships in Algeciras Bay, under the guns of the great Spanish batteries over against the Rock of Gibraltar. Jack was aware of all this. It was obvious in any case. And as Captain Palier muttered through his prints and drawings, Lansdowne Terrace, another view, Clifton, the pump room, his mind's eye pictured messengers riding at a great pace between Algeciras and Cadiz, for the Spaniards had no semaphore. His bodily eye, however, looked steadily through the window panes at Cabrita Point, the extremity of the bay. And presently it saw the t'gallant masts and pendant of a ship moving across behind the neck of land. He watched it placidly for some 2 or 3 seconds before his heart gave a great leap, having recognised the pendant as British before his head had even begun to weigh the matter. He darted a furtive look at Captain Palier, who cried, "Here we are, Laura Place, number 16 Laura Place. This is where my Christie cousins always stay when they come to Bath, and here, behind this tree..." You could see it better, was it not, for the tree, "is my bedroom window." A steward came in and began to lay the table, for Captain Palier not only possessed English cousins and the English language in something like perfection, but he had solid notions of what made a proper breakfast for a seafaring man. A pair of ducks, a dish of kidneys and a grilled turbot the size of a moderate cartwheel, were preparing, as well as the usual ham, eggs, toast, marmalade and coffee. Jack looked at the watercolour as attentively as he could and said, "Your bedroom window, sir, you astonish me." Breakfast with Dr. Ramis was a very different matter. Austere, if not penitential. A bowl of milkless cocoa, a piece of bread with a very little oil. "A very little oil cannot do us much harm," said Dr. Ramis, who was a martyr to his liver. He was a severe and meagre, dusty man with a harsh, greyish-yellow face and deep violet rings under his eyes. He didn't look capable of any pleasant emotion, yet he had both blushed and simpered when Stephen, upon being confided to his care as a prisoner guest, had cried, "Not the illustrious Dr. Juan Ramis, the author of the Specimen Animalium." Now they had just come back from visiting the Desais sick bay, a sparsely inhabited place, because of Dr. Ramis' passion for curing other people's livers too, by a low diet and no wine. It had a dozen of the usual diseases, a fair amount of pox, the Sophie's four invalids and the French wounded from the recent action, three men bitten by Mr. Dalziel's little bitch, whom they had presumed to caress. They were now confined upon suspicion of hydrophobia. In Stephen's view, there was an error in his colleague's reasoning. A Scotch dog that bit a French seaman was not, therefore, unnecessarily mad, though it might in this particular case be strangely wanting in discrimination. He kept this reflection to himself, however, and said, "I have been contemplating on emotion."
"Emotion?" said Dr. Ramis.
"Yes," said Stephen, "emotion and the expression of emotion. Now, in your fifth book, and in part of the sixth, you treat of emotion as it is shown by the cat, for example, the bull, the spider. I, too, have remarked the singular intermittent brilliance in the eyes of Lycosida. Have you ever detected a glow in those of the mantis?"
"Never, my dear colleague, though Busbequius speaks of it," replied Dr. Ramis with great complacency.
"But it seems to me that emotion and its expression are almost the same thing. Let's take your cat. Now, suppose we shave her tail so that it cannot, shall I say, perscopate or bristle. Suppose we attach a board to her back so that it cannot arch. Suppose we then exhibit a displeasing sight. A sportive dog, for instance. Now, she cannot express her emotions fully. Query, will she feel them fully? She will feel them, to be sure, since we have suppressed only the grossest manifestations. But will she feel them fully? Is not the arch, the bottle brush, an integral part and not merely a potent reinforcement? Though it is that too." Dr. Ramis inclined his head to one side, narrowed his eyes and lips, and said,
"How can it be measured? It cannot be measured. It is a notion. A most valuable notion, I'm sure. But, my dear sir, where is your measurement? It cannot be measured. Science is measurement. No knowledge without measurement."
"Indeed it can," cried Stephen eagerly. "Come, let us take our pulses." Dr. Ramis pulled out his watch, a beautiful Breguet with a center seconds hand, and they both sat gravely counting. "Now, dear colleague, pray be so good as to imagine, vehemently, that I have taken up your watch and wantonly flung it down. And I, for my part, will imagine that you are a very wicked fellow. Come, let us simulate the gestures, the expressions of extreme and violent rage." Dr. Rami's face took on a titanic look. His eyes almost vanished. His head reached forward, quivering. Stephen's lips writhed back. He shook his fist and gibbered a little. A servant came in with a jug of hot water. No second bowls of cocoa were allowed. "Now," said Stephen Maturin, "let's take our pulses again." "That pilgrim from the English sloop is mad," the surgeon's servant told the second cook. "Mad, twisted, tormented. An hour's isn't much better." "I will not say it is conclusive," said Dr. Ramis, "but it is wonderfully interesting. We must try the addition of harsh, reproachful words, cruel flings and bitter taunts, but without any physical motion which could account for part of the increase. You intend it as a proof per contra of what you advance, I take it. Reversed, inverted, or arsi versi, as you say in English. Most interesting." "Is it not?" said Stephen. "My mind was led into this train of thought by the spectacle of our surrender and of some others that I've seen. With your far greater experience of naval life, sir, no doubt you have been present at many more of these interesting occasions than I." "I imagine so," said Dr. Ramis. "For example, I myself have had the honour of being your prisoner no less than 4 times. That," he said with a smile, "is one of the reasons why we are so very happy to have you with us. It does not happen quite as often as we could wish." "Allow me to help you to another piece of bread. 1/2 a piece. With a very little garlic? Just a scrape of this wholesome antiphlogistical garlic." "You're too good, dear colleague. And you have no doubt taken notice of the impassive faces of the captured men. It is always so, I believe. Invariably. Zeno, followed by all his school. And does it not seem to you that this suppression, this denial of the outward signs, and as I believe reinforces, if not actually ingredients of the distress, does it not seem to you that this stoical appearance of indifference in fact diminishes the pain?" "It may well be so. Yes. I believe it is. There were men aboard whom I knew intimately well, and I'm morally certain that without this, what one might call, ceremony of diminution, it would have broken their—" "Monsieur, monsieur, monsieur!" cried Dr. Rami's servant. "The English are filling the bay!" On the poop they found Captain Palliere and his officers watching the manoeuvres of the Pompey, the Venerable, the Audacious, and farther off the Caesar, the Hannibal, and the Spencer, as they worked in on the light, uncertain westerly airs through the strong, shifting currents running between the Atlantic and the Mediterranean. They were all of them 74s. Except for Sir James' flagship, the Caesar, and she carried 80 guns. Jack stood at some distance with a detached look on his face, and at the farther rail there were the other quarter-deck Sophies, all making a similar attempt at decency. "Do you think they will attack?" asked Captain Palliere, turning to Jack. "Or do you think they will anchor off Gibraltar?" "To tell you the truth, sir," said Jack, looking over the sea at the towering rock, "I am quite sure that they will attack. And you will forgive me for saying that when you reckon up the forces in presence, it seems clear that we shall all be in Gibraltar tonight. I confess I'm heartily glad of it, for it will allow me to repay a little of the great kindness I have met with here." There had been kindness. Great kindness. From the moment they exchanged formal salutes on the quarter-deck of the Desaix, and Jack stepped forward to give up his sword. Captain Palliere had refused to take it, and with the most obliging expressions about the Sophie's resistance, had insisted upon his wearing it still. "Well," said Captain Palliere, "let it not spoil our breakfast, at all events." "Signal from the Admiral, sir," said the Lieutenant. "Warp in as close as possible to the batteries."
"Acknowledged, and make it so, de Manoir," said the Captain. "Come, sir, gather we rose pods while we may."
It was a gallant effort, and they both of them talked away with a fine perseverance, their voices rising as the batteries on Green Island and the mainland began to roar and the thundering broadsides filled the bay. But Jack found that presently he was spreading marmalade upon his turbot and answering somewhat at random. With a high-pitched, shattering crash, the stern windows of the Desai fell in ruin. The padded locker beneath, Captain Palliere's best wine bin, shot half across the cabin, projecting a flood of champagne, Madeira, and broken glass before it. And in the midst of the wreckage trundled a spent ball from HMS Pompeii.
"Perhaps we had better go on deck," said Captain Palliere.
It was a curious position. The wind had almost entirely dropped. The Pompeii had glided on past the Desai to anchor very close to the Formidable's starboard bow, and she was pounding her furiously as the French flagship warped farther in through the treacherous shoals by means of cables on shore. The Venerable, for want of wind, had anchored about half a mile from the Formidable and the Desai, and was plying them briskly with her larboard broadside, while the Audacious, as far as he could see through clouds of smoke, was abreast of the Indomptable, some 300 or 400 yards out. The Caesar and the Hannibal and the Spencer were doing their utmost to come up through the calms and the patchy gusts of west-nor-west breeze. The French ships were firing steadily. And all the time the Spanish batteries, from the Torre del Almirante in the north right down to Green Island in the south, thundered in the background, while the big Spanish gunboats, invaluable in this calm, with their mobility and their expert knowledge of the reefs and the strong turning currents, swept out to rake the anchored enemy. The rolling smoke drifted off the land, wafting now this way and now that, often hiding the rock at the far end of the bay and the three ships out to sea. But at last a steadier breeze sprang up, and the Caesar's royals and topgallants appeared above the obscurity. She was wearing Admiral Sumarez's flag, and she was flying the signal, "Anchor for mutual support." Jack saw her pass the Audacious and swing broadside on to the Desai within hailing distance. The cloud around her closed, hiding everything. There was a great stab as of lightning within the murk. A ball at head height reaped a file of marines on the Desai's poop, and the whole frame of the powerful ship shuddered with the force of the impact, at least half the broadside striking home.
"This is no place for a prisoner," reflected Jack, and with a parting look of particular consideration at Captain Palliere, he hurried down onto the quarter-deck. He saw Babington and young Ricketts standing doubtfully at the harnesses, and called out, "Get below, you two! This is no time to come at the old Roman. Proper flats you'd look cut in half with our own chain-shot." For Chain was coming in now, shrieking and howling over the sea. He shepherded them down into the cable tier, and then made his way to the wardroom quarter-gallery, the officer's privy. It was not the safest place in the world, but there was little room for a spectator between the decks of a man-of-war in action, and he desperately wanted to see the course of the battle. The Hannibal had anchored a little ahead of the Caesar, having run up the line of the French ships as they lay pointing north, and she was playing on the Formidable and the Santiago battery. The Formidable had almost ceased firing, which was as well, since for some reason the Pompeii had swung round in the current. Her spring shot away, perhaps, and she was head-on to the Formidable's broadside, so that she could now only engage the shore batteries and the gunboats with her starboard guns. The Spencer was still far out in the bay. But even so, there were 5 ships of the line attacking 3. Everything was going very well in spite of the Spanish artillery. And now, through a gap in the smoke torn by the west-nor-west breeze, Jack saw the Hannibal cut her cable, make sail towards Gibraltar, and tack as soon as she had way enough, coming down close inshore to run between the French admiral and the land,
and to cross his hawse and rake him. Just like the Nile, thought Jack. And at that moment the Hannibal ran aground, very hard aground, and brought up all standing right opposite the heavy guns of the Torre del Almirante. The cloud closed again, and when at last it lifted, boats were plying to and fro from the other English ships, and an anchor was carrying out. The Hannibal was roaring furiously at three shore batteries, at the gunboats, and, with her forward larboard guns and bow chasers, at the Formidable. Jack found that he was clasping his hands so hard that it needed strong determination to unknot them. The situation was not desperate, was not bad at all. The westerly air had fallen quite away, and now a right breeze was parting the heavy powder fog, coming from the northeast. The Caesar cut her cable, and coming down round the Venerable and the Audacious, she battered the Indomptable astern of the Dersay with the heaviest fire that had yet been heard. Jack couldn't make out what signal it was she had abroad, but he was certain it was cut and wear, together with engage the enemy more closely. There was a signal aboard the French admiral, too, cut and run aground. For now, with a wind that would allow the English to come right in, it was better to risk wrecking than total disaster. Furthermore, his was a signal easier to carry out than Sir James's, for not only did the breeze stay with the French after it had left the English becalmed, but the French already had their warps out and boats by the dozen from the shore. Jack heard the orders overhead, the pounding of feet, and the bay with its smoke and floating wreckage turned slowly before his eyes as the Dersay wore and ran straight for the land. She grounded with a thumping lurch that threw him off his balance on a reef just in front of the town. The Indomptable, with her foretopmast gone, was already ashore on Green Island, or precious near. He couldn't see the French flagship at all from where he was, but she would certainly have grounded herself too. And yet suddenly the battle went sour. The English ships didn't come in, sweep the stranded Frenchmen clean and burn or destroy them, far less tow them out. For not only did the breeze drop completely, leaving the Caesar, Audacious and Venerable with no steerage way, but almost all the surviving boats of the squadron were busy towing the shattered Pompey towards Gibraltar. The Spanish batteries had been throwing red-hot shot for some time, and now the grounded French ships were sending their excellent gun crews ashore by the hundred. Within a few minutes the fire of the shore guns increased enormously in volume and in accuracy. Even the poor Spencer, that had never managed to get up, suffered cruelly as she lay out there in the bay. The Venerable had lost her mizzen topmast, and it looked as though the Caesar were on fire amidships. Jack could bear it no longer. He hurried up on deck in time to see a breeze spring up off the land and the squadron make sail on the starboard tack, standing eastwards for Gibraltar, and leaving the dismasted, helpless Hannibal to her fate under the guns of the Torre del Almirante. She was firing still, but it could not last. Her remaining mast fell, and presently her ensign came wavering down.
"A busy morning, Captain Aubrey," said Captain Palliere, catching sight of him.
"Yes, sir," said Jack.
"I hope we have not lost too many of our friends."
The Dersay's quarter-deck was very ugly in patches, and there was a deep gutter of blood running along to the scupper under the wreckage of the poop-ladder. The hammock netting had been torn to pieces. There were four dismounted guns abaft the mainmast, and the splinter netting over the quarter-deck bowed and sagged under the weight of fallen rigging. She was canted three or four strakes on her rock, and the least hint of a sea would pound her to pieces.
"Many, many more than I could have wished," said Captain Palliere. "But the Formidable and the Indomptable have suffered worse, both their captains killed too. What are they doing aboard the captured ship?"
The Hannibal's colours were rising again. It was her own ensign, not the French flag. But it was the ensign reversed, flying with the Union downwards.
"I suppose they forgot to take a tricolour when they went to board her and take possession," observed Captain Palliere, turning to give orders for the heaving of his ship off the reef.
Some time later he came back to the shattered rail, and staring out at the little fleet of boats that were pulling with all their might from Gibraltar and from the sloop Calpe towards the Hannibal, he said to Jack, "You do not suppose they mean to retake the ship, do you? What are they about?"
Jack knew very well what they were about. In the Royal Navy, the reversed ensign was an emphatic signal of distress. The Calpe and the people in Gibraltar, seeing it, had supposed the Hannibal meant she was afloat again and was begging to be towed off. They had filled every available boat with every available man, with unattached seamen, and above all, with the highly skilled shipwrights and artificers of the dockyard. "Yes," he said with all the open sincerity of one bluff seaman talking to another, "I do. That's what they're about for sure. But certainly if you put a shot across the bow of the leading cutter, they'll turn around. They imagine everything's over."
"Ah, that's it," said Captain Palliere.
An 18-pounder creaked round and settled squarely on the nearest boat. "But come," said Captain Palliere, putting his hand on the lock and smiling at Jack, "perhaps it would be better not to fire." He countermanded the gun, and one by one the boats reached the Hannibal, where the waiting Frenchmen quietly led their crews below.
"Never mind," said Captain Palliere, patting him on the shoulder. "The Admiral is signalling. Come ashore with me, and we will try to find decent quarters for you and your people until we can heave off and refit."
The quarters allotted to the Sophie's officers, a house up at the back of Algeciras, had an immense terrace overlooking the bay, with Gibraltar to the left, Cabrita Point to the right, and the dim land of Africa looming ahead. The first person Jack saw upon it, standing there with his hands behind his back and looking down on his own dismasted ship, was Captain Ferris of the Hannibal. Jack had been shipmates with him during two commissions, and had dined with him only last year. But the post-captain was hardly recognisable as the same man, had aged terribly and shrunk. And although they now fought the battle over again, pointing out the various manoeuvres, misfortunes, and baffled intentions, he spoke slowly, with an odd, uncertain hesitation, as though what had happened were not quite real, or had not happened to him.
"So, you were aboard the Desaix, Aubrey," he said, after a while. "Was she much cut up?"
"Not so badly as to be disabled, sir, as far as I could collect.
She wasn't much hold below the waterline, and none of her lower masts was badly wounded. If she don't bilge, they'll put her to rights presently. She has an uncommon seaman-like set of officers and men."
"How many did she lose, do you suppose?"
"A good many, I'm sure. But here's my surgeon, who certainly knows more about it than I do. May I name Dr. Maturin, Captain Ferris?"
"My God, Stephen!" he cried, starting back. He was tolerably used to carnage, but he had never seen anything quite like this. Stephen might have come straight out of a busy slaughterhouse. His sleeves, the whole of the front of his coat up to his stock and the stock itself, were deeply soaked. Soaked through and through, and stiff with drying blood. So were his breeches. And wherever his linen showed it, too, was dark red-brown.
"Beg pardon," he said, "I should have shifted my clothes, but it seems that my chest was shattered, destroyed entirely."
"I can let you have a shirt and some breeches," said Captain Ferris. "We're much of a size."
Stephen bowed. "You've been lending the French surgeons a hand?" said Jack.
"Just so."
"Was there a great deal to do?" asked Captain Ferris.
"About 100 killed and 100 wounded," said Stephen.
"'We had 75 and 52,' said Captain Ferris. "'You belong to the Hannibal, sir?' asked Stephen. "'I did, sir,' said Captain Ferris. "'I struck my colours,' he said in a wondering tone, "'and at once began to sob, "'staring open-eyed at them, at one, and then at the other. "'Captain Ferris,' said Stephen, "'pray tell me, how many mates has your surgeon?' "'And have they all their instruments? "'I'm going down to the convent to see your wounded "'as soon as I've had a bite "'and I dispose of two or three sets.' "'Two mates, sir,' said Captain Ferris. "'As for their instruments, I fear I cannot say. "'It is good in you, sir, most Christian. "'Let me fetch you this shirt and breeches. "'You must be damned uncomfortable.' "'He came back with a bundle of clean clothes "'wrapped in a dressing gown, "'suggested that Dr. Matchedon might operate in the gown.' "'as he had seen done after the 1st of June, "'when there was a similar shortage of clean linen. "'And during their odd, scrappy meal, "'brought to them by staring, pitiful maid-servants "'with red and yellow sentries guarding the door, he said, "'After you have looked to my poor fellows, Dr. Maturin, "'if you have any benevolence left after you've looked at them, "'I say it would be a charitable act,' "'to prescribe me something in the poppy or mandragora line. "'I was strangely upset today, I must confess, "'and I need, what is it, the knitting up of ravelled care. "'And what is more, since we're likely to be exchanged in a few days, "'I shall have a court-martial on top of it all.' "'Oh, as for that, sir,' cried Jack, throwing himself back in his chair, "'you cannot possibly have any misgivings. "'Never was a clearer case of—' "'Don't you be so sure, young man,' said Captain Ferris. "'Any court-martial is a perilous thing, whether you're in the right or the wrong. "'Justice has nothing much to do with it. "'Remember poor Vincent of the Weymouth. "'Remember Bing, shot for an error of judgment and for being unpopular with the mob. "'And think of the state of feeling in Gibraltar and at home just now. 6 ships of the line beaten off by 3 French and 1 taken.' A defeat and the Hannibal taken. This degree of apprehension in Captain Ferris seemed to Jack a kind of wound, the result of lying hard aground under the fire of 3 shore batteries, a ship of the line and 12 heavy gunboats, and of being terribly hammered for hours, dismasted and helpless. The same thought, in a slightly different shape, occurred to Stephen. What is this trial of which he speaks? He asked later. Is it factual or imaginary? Oh, it's factual enough, said Jack. But he's done nothing amiss, surely. No one can pretend he ran away or didn't fight as hard as ever he could. But he lost his ship. Every captain of a king's ship that is lost must stand his trial at court-martial. I see. A mere formality in his case, no doubt. In his case, yes, said Jack. His anxiety is unfounded. A sort of waking nightmare, I take it. But the next day, when he went down with Mr. Dalziel to see the Sophie's crew in their disaffected church, and to tell them of the flag of truce from the rock, it seemed to him a little more reasonable, less of a sick fantasy. He told the Sophies that both they and the Hannibals were to be exchanged, that they should be in Gibraltar for dinner, dried peas and salt horse for dinner, no more of these foreign messes. And although he smiled and waved his hat at the roaring cheers that greeted his news, there was a black shadow in the back of his mind. The shadow deepened as he crossed the bay in the Caesar's barge. It deepened as he waited in the antechamber to report himself to the Admiral. Sometimes he sat, and sometimes he walked up and down the room, talking to other officers as people with urgent business were admitted by the secretary. He was surprised to receive so many congratulations on the Cacafuego action. It seemed so long ago now as almost to belong to another life. But the congratulations, though both generous and kind, were a little on the cursory side, for the atmosphere in Gibraltar was one of severe and general condemnation, dark depression, strict attention to arduous work, and a sterile wrangling about what ought to have been done. When at last he was received, he found Sir James almost as old and changed as Captain Ferris. The Admiral's strange, heavy-lidded eyes looked at him virtually without expression as he made his report. There was not a word of interruption, not a hint of praise or blame. And this made Jack so uneasy that if it had not been for a list of heads he'd written on a card that he kept in the palm of his hand, like a schoolboy, he would have deviated into rambling explanations and excuses. The Admiral was obviously very tired, but his quick mind extracted the necessary facts, and he noted them down on a slip of paper.
"What do you make of the state of the French ships, Captain Aubrey?" he asked.
"The Desaix is now afloat, sir, and pretty sound. So is the Indomitable.
I don't know about the Formidable and Hannibal, but there's no question of their being bilged. And in Algeciras the rumour is that Admiral Lenoir sent three officers to Cadiz yesterday, and another early this morning, to beg the Spaniards and Frenchmen there to come round and fetch him out."
Admiral Saumarez put his hand to his forehead. He had honestly believed they would never float again, and he had said as much in his report.
"Well, thank you, Captain Aubrey," he said after a moment, and Jack stood up. "I see you're wearing your sword," observed the Admiral.
"Yes, sir, the French captain was good enough to give it back to me."
"Very handsome in him, though I'm sure the compliment was quite deserved. And I have little doubt the court-martial will do the same. But, you know, it's not quite etiquette to ship it until then. We will arrange your business as soon as possible. Poor Ferris will have to go home, of course, but we can see to you here. You're only on parole, I believe."
"Yes, sir, waiting for an exchange."
"What a sad bore. I could have done with your help. The squadron's in such a state." "Ah, good day to you, Captain Aubrey," he said with a hint of a smile, or at least a lightening in his expression. "As you know, of course, you're under nominal arrest, so pray be discreet." He'd known it perfectly well, of course, in theory, but the actual words were a blow to his heart. And he walked through the crowded, busy streets of Gibraltar in a state of quite remarkable unhappiness. When he reached the house where he was staying, he unbuckled his sword, made an ungainly parcel of it, and sent it down to the Admiral's secretary with a note. Then he went for a walk, feeling strangely naked and unwilling to be seen. The officers of the Hannibal and the Sophie were on parole, that is to say, until they were exchanged for French prisoners of equal rank, they were bound in honour to do nothing against France or Spain. But they were merely prisoners in more agreeable surroundings. The days that followed were singularly miserable and lonely. Lonely, although he sometimes walked with Captain Ferris, sometimes with his own midshipman, and sometimes with Mr. Dalziel and his dog. It was strange and unnatural to be cut off from the life of the port and the squadron at such a moment as this, when every able-bodied man, and a good many who should never have got out of their beds at all, were working furiously to repair their ships. An active hive, an ant-hill down below, and up here, on these heights, on the thin grass and the bare rock, between the Moorish wall and the tower above Monkey's Cove, solitary, self-communing doubt, reproach, and anxiety. He had looked through all the gazettes, of course, and there was nothing about either the Sophie's triumph or her disaster. One or two garbled accounts in the newspapers, and a paragraph in the Gentleman's Magazine that made it seem like a surprise attack, that was all.
as many as a dozen promotions in the gazettes, but none for him or Pullings. And it was a fair bet that the news of the Sophie's capture had reached London at about the same time as that of the Cacafuego, if not before. For the good news, supposing it to have been lost, supposing it to have been in the bag he himself sank in 90 fathoms off Cape Roig, could only have come in a dispatch from Lord Keith, far up the Mediterranean among the Turks. So there could not be any promotion now until after the court-martial. No such thing as a promotion of prisoners ever. And what if the trial went wrong? His conscience was very far from being perfectly easy. If Hart had meant this, he'd been devilishly successful. And he, Jack, had been a famous greenhorn, an egregious flat. Was such malignity possible? Such cleverness in a mere horned scrub? He would have liked to put this to Stephen, for Stephen had a headpiece, and Jack, almost for the first time in his life, was by no means sure of his perfect comprehension, natural intelligence, and penetration. The Admiral had not congratulated him. Could that conceivably mean that the official view was... But Stephen had no notion of any parole that would keep him out of the naval hospital. The squadron had had more than 200 men wounded, and he spent almost all his time there. "You go a-walking," he said. "Do, for all love, go walking up very steep heights. Traverse the rock from end to end. Traverse it again and again on an empty stomach. You're an obese subject. Your hams quiver as you go. You must weigh 16 or even 17 stone. And to be sure, I do sweat like a mare in foal," he reflected, sitting under the shade of a boulder, loosening his waistband and mopping himself. In an attempt at diverting his mind, he privately sang a ballad about the Battle of the Nile. "We anchored alongside of them like lions bold and free. When their masts and shrouds came tumbling down, what a glorious sight to see. Then came the bold Leander, that noble 54, and on the bows of the Franklin she caused her guns to roar, gave her a dreadful drubbing, boys, and did severely maul, which caused them loud for quarter cry and down French colours haul." The tune was charming, but the inaccuracy vexed him. The poor old Leander had 52 guns, as he knew very well, having directed the fire of 8 of them. He turned to another favourite naval song. "There happened of late a terrible fray begun upon our St. James Day, with a thump, 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 thump. An ape on a rock no great way off threw a turd at him quite unprovoked, and when he half rose in protest, it shook its wizened fist and gibbered so furiously that he sank down again, so low were his spirits. 'Sir! Sir!' cried Babington, tearing up the slope, scarlet with hailing and climbing. 'Look at the brig, sir! Look over the point!' The brig was the Pasley. They knew her at once, the hired brig Pasley, a fine sailor, and she was crowding sail on the brisk nor'west breeze, fit to carry everything away. 'Have a look, sir!' said Babington, collapsing on the grass in a singularly undisciplined manner and handing up a little brass spyglass. The tube only magnified weakly, but at once the signal flying from the Pasley's masthead leapt out clear and plain. 'Enemy in sight!' 'And there they are, sir,' said Babington, pointing to a glimmer of topsails over the dark curve of the land beyond the end of the gut. 'Come on!' cried Jack, and began labouring up the hill, gasping and moaning, running as fast as he could for the tower, the highest point on the rock. There were some masons up there working on the building, an officer of the garrison artillery with a splendid great telescope, and some other soldiers. The gunner very civilly offered Jack his glass. Jack lent it on Babington's shoulder, focused carefully, gazed, and said, 'There's the Superb and the Thames. Then 2 Spanish 3-deckers. One's the Real Carlos, I'm almost sure. Vice-Admiral's flagship, in any event. 2 74s. No, a 74 and probably an 80-gun ship. Argonauta, said one of the Masons. Another three-decker and three frigates, two French. They sat there, silently watching the steady, calm procession. The Superb and the Thames keeping their stations just a mile ahead of the combined squadron.